Hi, podcast listeners. It's Anne here. One of this fall's big books, maybe the biggest, is Colson Whitehead's sweeping new historical novel about the Underground Railroad. It's an unflinching look at the experience of slavery, and it's hard to forget. It was also hard to write.
It was terrible, and I had to galvanize myself to start writing once I had amassed all this material and realized the terrible time I was going to put Cora and all the other characters through just in order to make a realistic plantation. But once I found a narrative voice that worked, a register that allowed for brutality, reality, and philosophy, I was able to push on. And, my office is in the basement of our house, and we have two floors, and I could always, even though I was dealing with very difficult material all day, come 3 p.m., I come upstairs and rejoin the family and could be a human again, yes.
Critics have welcomed the Underground Railroad with over-the-top praise. In fact, it's just been long-listed for a National Book Award. Now, in Colson's imagination, the Underground Railroad is an actual Underground Railroad, complete with locomotives and boxcars and conductors. So it's partly an alternative history. But the characters themselves were inspired by real history, the classic slave narratives of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs. In this story, a young slave named Cora grows up on a brutal plantation in Georgia, and another slave named Caesar urges her to escape. And so Cora heads north, with slave catchers on her heels, looking for that Underground Railroad. Here's Steve Paulson's full-length interview with Colson Whitehead, and here's how the story begins.
The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea, two by two. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep up the pace of the long march, the slavers stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for cowrie shells and glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase. 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder. Able-bodied men and childbearing women fetched more than juveniles. This was the ship's final port of call before they crossed the Atlantic. Two yellow-haired sailors rowed Ajari out to the ship, humming, white skin like bone.
So Cora, your main character, is a third-generation slave, and until she escapes when she's 15, she has never known any kind of life except that brutal life on the plantation that she's lived on. How would you describe her?
She's being described to me as a badass, which I find endearing. Her mother, Mabel, has run away years before, and she exists on the plantation as a stray, someone with no family, and forced to fend for herself. It takes a unique personality to contemplate being able to lead the plantation, a certain kind of bravery and strength that I'm not sure I would have had if I was in her place 150 years ago. So, just being able to run from the plantation and aim herself north towards the moon, she's a formidable personality.
And so this becomes a story of how Cora starts to gain some control over her own life. I mean, some sense of agency when she's had none. But just as she's sort of developing this internal power, the forces all around her are closing in. I mean, of course, there is the racism of the 19th century, and especially the slave catchers who are chasing after her.
Sure. I mean, I think a story of an escape from plantation is already an adventure story. In this case, I've come up with a different culture for every state that she moves through as she moves north. So North Carolina has a personality, South Carolina, Georgia.
What was the idea for that, that you sort of created these fictional cultures for each state?
Well, I had the idea to explore what if the Underground Railroad was an actual railroad, that sort of childish idea you have before you figure out how things work. And that's a premise, not much of a story. So to complicate it, I followed the example of Gulliver's Travels, where each sort of state is a new island where we can see a different aspect of America explored in a way that Gulliver would go from island to island, and each one provided a critique of British society 200 years ago. And, you know, I had this idea many years ago, and I came up with a white supremacist state, a black separatist state, a state where slaves are freed and given jobs and housing and education. And these different cultures allow me to critique different aspects of American history. And so in South Carolina, where she's giving a job and opportunity, I was, you know, exploring the idea of the Great Society programs of the 60s. How do social programs work, not work, and how can I pervert them to talk about the changing concept of race in America?
So you've created your own alternative history. I mean, obviously, you're very familiar with the real history of 19th century slavery, but you're tweaking it all over the place. Is that so you can sort of play with ideas in a more creative way?
Sure. I mean, you know, my idea was I was not going to stick to the facts, but I would stick to the truth. And so what is slavery about? You know, I think once I made the decision to make a literal train, I was free from, you know, a certain burden of realism. And I could mix and match different episodes from American history to tell a different story than the one America sort of tells itself.
Of course, there's also a long tradition of slave narratives. I mean, a very rich tradition of actual stories of slaves who escaped. How were you sort of playing off of that literary legacy?
Well, you know, they were my main avenue of research. There's a great history of the railroad called Bound for Canaan by Fergus Bordwich that came out 8 years ago. But after that, I really looked to the classic slave narratives of Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs was a slave in North Carolina who ran away from her master and hid in an attic for 7 years before getting passage out of the state. And then in the 1930s, FDR, being the nice guy we know from history, during the Great Depression, decided to put writers back to work. And he hired, through the Works Progress Administration, writers to interview former slaves, people who were kids or teenagers at the time of the Civil War, and to collect this, you know, this great history before they, you know, passed on. And so they interviewed hundreds of former slaves. Some of the accounts are just 2 pages, some are 10 pages. But they gave me a real sense of the variety of slave experience and provided me with a lot of the details that hopefully make the first section real. And Georgia, the first section is hopefully as realistic as I can make it. And I wanted to just be loyal to my nameless great-great-great-great-grandparents who died anonymously in the slave system, and also the people whose stories I was reading. And so before I depart into, you know, these different fantastic avenues, I wanted to play it straight and hopefully pay tribute to them.
So as you were doing your research, I mean, reading the old slave narratives like the one written by Harriet Jacobs or these later accounts from the 1930s, were there particular eye-opening moments for you where you sort of thought, wow, I had no idea?
Well, you know, the first day I remember reading just in a very casual way, one of the former slaves says, you know, once a year, master would give us new wooden shoes. And that just seems so crazy. I mean, I don't associate wooden shoes with America.
Yeah, I associate them with the Dutch.
Yes, exactly. So how does it work? Like the slave master just makes a bulk order every year. And so there's some woodworker nearby who, you know, is like, oh, the Brando Plantation's going to have their annual order, have to get kiddie shoes and adult shoes. And so it just, you know, set my mind abuzz with how complicated and unknowable the slave system was. Everything was accounted for, including an annual bulk purchase of wooden shoes for your slaves. You know, they would call the slaves' clothes Negro cloth. I guess if you have a cheap piece of material that's only fit for Negroes, you call it Negro cloth. And so just the mentality of the slavers and the matter-of-fact way that the former slaves talked about their former lives wound its way into the book.
I would think writing about the slave experience would be awfully intimidating because, I mean, there has been so much written about slavery, so much good writing, I mean, both fiction and history. did you sort of wonder, could you say anything new? I mean, figure out a way into this?
Well, you know, that's always a problem. Sometimes when I work on a book, I want to go see how other people approach it. Sometimes I don't. But this time, you know, I hadn't read Beloved by Toni Morrison in like 25 years or The Known World by Edward Jones in 12 years. And so I was like, oh, I'll see how they do it. And so, of course, I read 30 pages of Beloved and was like, oh, I'm totally screwed. Like, you can't beat Toni Morrison, you know.
She's already done this.
But no matter what you're writing about, whether it's war or family or race, in all likelihood, someone smarter and more talented than you has done it before. So all you can do is trust that you have something new to say, something unique from your perspective that you can add to the body of literature. And maybe you're number 20 on the list of slave novels and not, you know, in the top 10, but you did the best you could.
So was it these elements of fantasy that you brought in? I mean, the counterfactual pieces of history and sort of playing with bits of more recent history that you incorporated into your story. Was that the way to make it fresh?
It's not the way I thought about it, but it was my first thought on how to elaborate on the premise of a literal railroad and I stuck with it. Over the years, you know, I think the different jumps to each state island were much more broad, and so South Carolina would take place in the future in a much more starkly fantastic locale. Tennessee in this book is a wasteland of forest fires and the yellow plague, but it was much more of a, you know, wasteland from sci-fi movies, I think. And as I got closer to writing, it seemed like maybe a more low-key approach to the fantasy might work better. And so instead of having the fantastic effects cranked up to like a Spinal Tapian 11, what if I just had him on one, you know, a slow simmer? And so all the technology and slang has an 1850 cutoff date, and everyone has a sort of matter-of-fact reaction to all the fantastic things that are going on. And I think it served, you know, Cora's story.
Do you ever worry, or did you worry as you were writing this, that, I mean, by incorporating sci-fi aspects or, you know, pieces of from other parts of history that, I don't know, you distort the history, that you would offend people?
It never occurred to me at all. You know, I grew up as someone who didn't like to leave the house, and I always watched Twilight Zone and Star Trek and read a lot of horror. And as a 8-year-old, 9-year-old, and it seemed the people whose work I responded to when I first started reading were people who talked about the world through the filter of fantasy. You know, by adopting a different perspective, we can see the world in a different way. So for me, you know, it seems like a natural tool of storytelling. Sometimes you want to be realistic, and sometimes, you know, maybe coming at something sideways is the way to go.
And there definitely is sort of a Twilight Zone aspect to this. And there are parts of this story that are very funny, even though obviously you're dealing with an incredibly serious and depressing subject.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my last book was a book about the World Series of Poker, and it's basically a humor book, and I was just trying to cram in as many jokes as possible onto every page. And definitely from doing the research and thinking about what my ancestors had gone through and the people they knew, that my usual satirical distancing effects just wouldn't work. And so, you know, here and there, I think my sardonic point of view leaks in, but it's very rare.
Have you actually done research on your own family history, your own genealogy? I mean, how far back can you go back and find the slaves in your own family history?
No, I mean, there's this line on my mother's family, and they've kept records of previous generations who worked on a colored tavern in Virginia going back 200 years. My grandmother on my father's side was in Barbados, and that was a huge sugar plantation hub. But I don't know anything about her family before she came to America through Ellis Island. Other parts of my family come from Virginia and Florida. Is that where they first started? Were they in Georgia? You know, the closest I can probably come to reconstructing is following my sister's request that I take a DNA swab. And for some reason, she wanted me and my brother to take a mouth swab, and that would tell us where in Africa we came from, interior, west coast, east coast. I've not done that. It hasn't actually occurred to me, but she keeps nagging me, so I'll probably do it.
There's one thing I have to ask you about. You have these great scenes in your alternative history. In South Carolina, after Cora's escape, she takes a job in a place called the Museum of Natural Wonders. where there's a section in the museum called Living History, and she's supposed to enact the life of a slave. There's one exhibit called Scenes from Darkest Africa. Another one is called Life on the Slave Ship. And I mean, this is totally sanitized a view of history where slaves sew with spinning wheels on the ships coming over to America, of course, all on display for the white visitors to the museum. Where'd you get this idea?
You know, a lot of the more absurd moments in the book are inspired by real life. And so at the great world's fairs in the 1800s, African-Americans were put into so-called jungle garb and supposed to act like jungle natives for the audience, for people who would come and see. And that was this sort of fake representation of the Dark Continent.
It was like a zoo, basically, except for there were actual human beings there.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it sounds absurd, but that's how it actually happened. And, of course, you know, P.T. Barnum and carnivals would put black people on display to represent the Dark Continent. And so, as a writer, I'm trying to figure out ways for Cora to interact with history and give her opportunities to grow and understand the world and herself. And so by putting her in this artificial environment, this artificial display of an African village, a slave ship, a plantation, I get to depict her growing awareness of who she is and how fake the white version of history is, and how her own experience can actually provide a more true account of how the world works.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of this piece of your novel. And there's a moment where Cora finally decides to kind of fight back in her own way. Could you read that?
Certainly. There are two other former slaves who work in the museum with her, and one of them just asked if they could switch rotations. Cora hated the ludicrous slave display and preferred to get it over as soon as possible. The progression from plantation to slave ship to Darkest Africa generated a soothing logic. It was like going back in time and an unwinding of America. Ending her day in scenes from Darkest Africa never failed to cast her into a river of calm, the simple theater becoming more than theater, a genuine refuge. But Cora agreed to her friend's request, and she would end the day a slave. In the fields, back in the plantation, she was ever under the merciless eye of the overseer or boss. Bend your backs, work that row. Her recent installation in the exhibit returned her to the furrows of Georgia, the dumb, open-jawed stares of the patrons stealing her back to a state of display. One day she decided to retaliate against a red-haired white woman who scowled at the sight of Cora's duty on the ship. Cora didn't know the source of her animus or care. The woman irked her. Cora stared into her eyes, unwavering and fierce, until the woman broke, fairly running from the glass towards the agricultural section. From then on, Cora selected one patron per hour to evil eye. A young clerk ducking out from his office in the Griffin Building, a man of enterprise. A harried matron corralling an unruly clutch of children. One of the sour youths who liked to batter the glass and startle Cora. Sometimes this one, sometimes that one. She picked the weak links out of the crowd, the ones who broke under her gaze. The weak link. She liked the ring of it. The people she chose, young and old, from the rich part of town or the more modest streets, did not individually persecute Cora. As a community, there were shackles. If she kept at it, chipping away at the weak links wherever she found them, it might add up to something. She got good at her evil eye, looking up from the slave wheel or the hut's glass fire to pin a person in place like one of the beetles or mites in the insect exhibits. They always broke, the people, not expecting this weird attack, staggering back or looking at the floor or forcing their companions to pull them away. It was a fine lesson, Cora thought, to learn that the slave, the African in your midst, is looking at you too.
Now, that is such a great passage. In my reading of this part of your book, and really sort of a through line throughout the whole book, is you're partly commenting on how the history of slavery has been sanitized throughout our own culture in books and movies. Because to truly show how violent, how dehumanizing it was, it's almost unbearable to see.
Well, I mean, who wants to think about it, you know, white or black? I think when I was in school, and perhaps other people went to better schools, but it seems like you learn about slavery in fifth grade, and then you learn about Lincoln, and that's it. And then you hear about the Civil Rights Movement and Jim Crow and separate but equal. And then Martin Luther King comes, and, you know, it's one day, and that's our whole lesson on race relations. If you are from the South and your great-great-great-grandfather had slaves, do you want to contemplate the tortures, brutality, rapes, and abuse that he perpetrated upon his property? If you were third-generation college African-American, your family has risen into the middle class, achieved the American dream, do you want to think about what happened 200 years ago, 150 years ago? Obviously, it depends on your personality. But it is terrible to contemplate, and it's uncomfortable. And a lot of the work I'm trying to do in the book is try to make links between what happened 150 years ago and now. And can we look at the past and see how some of the systems are still in place, are still reverberating through time?
What are some of those links that you see between 150 years ago and now?
You know, we could talk about the assault on the black body. 150 years ago, the police force in the South was the slave patroller. And a slave patroller would roam around plantations. They could enter any free black person's house and demand to see their papers.
And they had perfect legal right to do all of this.
Sure, yeah. No training, just license as young white men to stop a new black person. And if you were caught, you could be brought to jail, beaten. The penalty at the height of the cotton era for running away was a death penalty. And so your owner had, at his or her discretion, could have you put to death. You know, the slave patroller had complete control over any black person they saw. They could to stop them. And of course, the echo of that in policing now, you know, is not too hard to discern. I was taught at a young age that, you know, whenever I leave the house, I'm a target, and I can't rely on the police to protect me. I'm immediately viewed as a thug, a villain, and I can be stopped at any time. And, you know, of course, like a lot of people, I've been, you know, stopped in a car for driving while black. I've been handcuffed and interrogated. So, you know, that sort of casual abuse, which can often escalate into lethal abuse, is definitely part of my American experience. And so it's not too hard to find the linkages between the two.
Yeah. So what do you think fiction can do to help us deal with, I mean, this trauma, this collective national trauma, slavery, that even a really good historical account cannot do?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I just write my weird little novels and hope that they work. You know, I am talking about the Holocaust in relation to slavery. I'm talking about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment in the context of slavery. And, you know, not being faithful the way the historian has to be faithful allowed me to, you know, pick up different strands about how race has played out in America and play with them and hold them up to the light. And so, you know, the novel covers a lot of territory in a way I think you couldn't do if you were being faithful to the historical record. So changing things, fictionalizing things, and taking liberties allowed me to create a different kind of truth that may not be fact-checkable, but hopefully resonates.
Yeah. It's a remarkable book, and thank you for coming in and talking about it.
No, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That's Colson Whitehead talking with Steve Paulson about his novel, The Underground Railroad. It's just been named one of the finalists for the National Book Award. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and if you like conversations with writers, thinkers, and cultural figures, you should be a regular listener. To find more episodes of To the Best of Our Knowledge, check our podcast feed. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by PRI.
WRI, Public Radio International.